This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, a hub for homebrewers since 1978. Visit homebrewersassociation.org for award-winning recipes, brewing tips, and community. homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 9th, 2020. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Jim Loughran, author of A Beer Drinker's Guide to Knowing and Enjoying Fine Wine, gives us some tips from the grape side. As beer lovers, how do we expand our world toward finding and enjoying tasty wines? If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other basic brewing gear. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Steve and I are planning to get together to record video and audio episodes soon. Right after I got over my recent respiratory affliction, Steve got something similar. So we're under the weather, right after another. I'm hoping we'll be all better by early next week to record new material. One of the topics that we'll be talking about is a hop stand length experiment. I took the basic hop sampler recipe, and I varied the length of time that the hops stayed in the hot wort before chilling. I usually just do 30 minutes, but I did just flame out and then chill right away, 10 minutes, and then 30 minutes. So we've got those. It's all the same hop. It's all Cascade. It's just that the length of time that we kept, I kept those in there in the hot wort at the end is different. So that'll be a fun one to test. Let's hear a word from our friends and sponsors at Tavor. Tavor is a way to select delicious craft beers that you may not be able to find in your area and have them delivered to you. It's not a beer of the month club where somebody else, some random person, randomly chooses things for you. You only pay for the beer that you choose over the course of the month. Signing up for Tavor is free. Just create an account at Tavor.com. That's T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com. And download their iPhone or Android app, and you'll receive notifications for two new beers each day that are available for purchase with in-depth tasting notes from Philip at Tavor. Megan at Tavor is very excited about this month's selections. She says that Tavor will be featuring Jay Wakefield, Tired Hands, Hardywood Park, Zillicoa, Masthead, Cellar Maker, Divine Barrel, Kent Falls, Moonraker, Kelly Green, and King's Brewing. So, if you're not interested in those beers, but if you see beers that you're not interested in on the app, no worry, just skip the ones that you don't want. However, when you see something that you do want, and you will, don't wait, just click on it and add it to your crate. The beer arrives fresh every few weeks, allowing enough time to fill a box and pay the least shipping. So why don't you check it out? It doesn't cost anything to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase anything. If I can ask you a favor, go to Tavor.com, T-A-V as in Victor, O-U-R.com. Or download the app, and when you sign up, enter the promo code BASICBREWING, all one word, and you'll get $10 off your first shipment of $25 or more. So $10 by using the promo code BASICBREWING, all one word. Again, it's free to sign up, and there's no obligation to purchase. Sign up at Tavor.com or the Tavor app and enter BASICBREWING as the promo code. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Josh writes, I'm a long-time yet infrequent home brewer who would like to brew more often than I do. The constraints that I have are typically financial in source and tend to build off one another. My equipment, mostly on the fermentation side, is a setup for small batch brewing, 3 gallons or fewer, but this leads to more expensive per bottle costs, which usually sway me to not brew but for special occasions. Josh says, I could revamp my fermentation equipment, but it's hard to justify the costs. After much thought about my process, I've decided to focus on lowering my brew day ingredient costs rather than increasing fermentation capacity. My question for you is, do you have any advice on doing that when it comes to small batch brewing, specifically keeping ingredient waste to a minimum? Well, thanks, Josh. I've personally taken some steps to keep ingredient waste down in my brewing, small batches and bigger batches. For example, I'll usually round off my recipes to the whole pound for base malts and a whole ounce for specialty grains, because that's what Steve's Brew Shop sells, those increments. So I'm not buying more than I need and then, you know, like storing it and saying, oh, I'll use that later and then not using it. And for small extract batches, Steve at Steve's Brew Shop sells 1 pound bags of DME, and I'm sure your homebrew shop, your local homebrew shop does as well. So that's easy if you can buy 1 pound bags of the dry malt extract. Nowadays, I just buy what I need for each recipe and don't try to stockpile, you know, giant bags of grain, for example, like I used to. I think I still have some really stale base malt and specialty grains somewhere in the house. Hops is where it gets tricky. However, you can try techniques like, you know, sliding hop additions for pale ales, especially closer to the end of the boil. This lessens the IBUs, which is important if you're using a high alpha hop, and it also increases the hop flavor. So you can kind of play with the hop placement to maximize optimize your IBUs and then also increase your hop flavor and aroma. So if you are buying in, say, 1 ounce packets, you have to worry less about leftover hops that might stale over time. I have found that I can save leftover hops. Thanks to the Hop Sampler series, I often have partial ounces of hops left over. So what I do is I just fold those packets over, seal them, and then keep them in the freezer. And I have used hops that have been kept that way for several weeks. Now, some leftover portions didn't fare as well, to be honest. I smelled them, and they didn't smell the great, you know, and they didn't look as green, so I didn't use those. But I was able to use a bunch in my dry-hopped 15-minute Saison recently that you saw on the video episode, and those were really tasty, and those have been in the freezer for a while. So, last but not least, you can reuse yeast either by using a portion of the slurry from one small batch to go directly into the next batch from the fermenter, or by harvesting the yeast and keeping it in the fridge for the future. Of course, you know, that brings in another level of sanitization and discipline in that way, but it would save you some money. So I hope that's food for thought, Josh. If you out there have some tips or tricks that you can use or that you use to economize, especially for small batches, drop me a line. I'll pass that along. Speaking of saving money, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa are running a special in January just for Basic Brewing Radio listeners. 20% off beer and wine kits all this month, just for you guys. Just use the code BB20N20JAN on highgravitybrew.com when you shop for beer and wine kits. You'll save 20% off. That's a great deal. If you look at highgravitybrew.com this month on the homepage, some of the featured beer kits are Catherine II Russian Imperial Stout, Boggy Bottom Barley Wine, and Northern Lights Winter Ale. Now, those are high gravity beers, so 20% off those can save you a bunch. And if you make wine kits, you know that making your own wine is easy, especially compared to beer, and it is less expensive per bottle than buying commercial wines. Now, with this special, it's even 20% less expensive. You just have to remember the code. So get a pen, BB20N20JAN. That's BB20IN20JAN. BB20N20JAN. HighGravityBrew.com is the place for electric brewing solutions and tons of great beer and wine kits, along with everything else that you need for home brewing. BB20N20JAN at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com during January for 20% off beer and wine kits. Highgravitybrew.com. Okay, I've had an inferiority complex, to be honest, when it comes to wine. I want to explore and enjoy wine more along with make more of it at home. But I kind of want to know what I'm doing. You know, I want to know what I'm making, for example. So when I saw the title to Jim's book, A Beer Drinker's Guide to Knowing and Enjoying Fine Wine, I thought it would be a great opportunity to expand my horizons. Jim Loughran, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thank you so much, James. It's a delight to be with you.
You are the author of 50 Ways to Love Wine More, Adventures in Wine Appreciation, most recently, and then A Beer Drinker's Guide to Knowing and Enjoying Fine Wine, which really caught my attention when I heard of it, because I am a home brewer, and I've tipped my toe into making wine, but I'm intimidated by the whole wine thing. It's just, I can walk up to a refrigerator full of craft beers and I feel at home. And then I turn around and there's this sea of bottles that are just mystifying to me. So I want to make more wine, you know, in my hobby, but I need some demystification. Can you help?
Well, I hope so. Actually, very interesting genesis for the book. For years, taught many wine classes, and of course, I had a lot of students who would come to me after the class and say, you know, I love wine and my friends all drink wine, but my husband/boyfriend/significant other/whoever it was is a true beer lover, and I just can't get him or her interested in wine. So are there any tips you can give me to maybe help me bridge that gap? So we had what I've come to refer to as cross-drinking couples. one likes the grains and one likes the grapes. And, you know, how do you bring the two together? And I'll be honest with you, I don't know that you ever bring the two completely together, nor should you bring them completely together. I think one thing that beer lovers will agree on completely with wine lovers, and that is the first thing you have to be true to is your own palate. So whatever the critics say or whatever the writers say or whatever the gurus say, if you like it, it's good. And if you don't like it, it's not good for you. Hmm. So if you really love and favor the flavor profile and the taste that you get with beer, be it an ale or whatever, you're more prone to that, you're built that way, then why give up beer? And on the other hand, if you're more attuned to the flavors of grapes and fruit, then why give up wine? But that being said, there's so many similarities. And, you know, there's a saying in the wine world that says, no good wine was made without great beer. And what that refers to, quite honestly, is the harvest, or what's called crush, when the grapes are ripe and winemakers go into their, you know, CPA at tax time mode, where they're working 12, 15 hours a day for 8 or 10 weeks, and that's really the bulk of their work for the year. But there's nothing that a cellar rat loves more than a nice cold brew at the end of that day, I'm telling you. So the guy who shows up with a good six-pack is a hero in every winery during crush. So, you know, each of them has its own properties and attributes, and I think it's just being comfortable, you know, not letting one or the other intimidate you. So as you mentioned a little earlier, you can stand in front of the fridge in the market and look at 200 different beers or craft brews and feel very comfortable and feel at home. And yet if you turn around and you see the shelf with 200 different wines on it, it kind of blows your mind. You're going, you know, what are these things and what's in these bottles, and is this something I'm going to like or not like or whatever. And in all honesty, there's an element in the wine world that want to keep it that way. You know, they want to protect their turf, if you will. So if you're intimidated by it, then they appoint themselves as the arbiter. You know, they can explain it to you. They can show it to you, whether it's sommeliers or wine writers or whatever. If everyone understood it and loved it, they'd be out of a job. So I think you just have to relax and realize, again, that it's your palate. You know, you try things, and if you like them, do it again, or go to your good wine shop and ask the retailer if there's something similar to that. And if you don't like it, then make note of that as well, that I just don't care. Maybe it's a varietal. Maybe you try a Cabernet Sauvignon and you just don't like it for whatever reason. It doesn't matter what the reason is. Then stop trying it. You know, don't buy another one. Go try a Chianti instead, a wine from Italy. Or go try anything else. Try a Zinfandel from California. So I think that we just need to be a little freer and a little more relaxed. And in terms of what you like or don't like, just go with your own, not your gut, but your tongue, you know, your own tongue, because your own tongue will never steer you wrong.
I would assume that that someone with a well-developed beer palate would be better to take or more easily trained as a wine connoisseur than someone who's starting from scratch. Is that true or not?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, when you look at doing what we call a sensory evaluation, whether it's on beer or wine, there are certain aspects of the liquid, if you will, that are important. One is the color. One, of course, is the clarity of the beer or the wine. Another is the aroma. Obviously, with beer, you want to assess when you're looking at it. You're going to be assessing the head as well, something you don't do when you're looking at wine. Hopefully, your wine doesn't have a head on it. If it does, you may want to take that bottle back right away. But yes, you know, it's really a matter, all of this geeky wine tasting things. You know, in wine, we've got the six S's, you know, see, sniff, swirl, swallow, and savor. All right, well, that's great. And in beer, there is a similar approach, but all of it really is paying attention. Instead of just gulping it down, just pay attention. How does this smell to you? Is the smell appealing? Is the smell unique? As you begin to learn more about either beer or wine, does the smell tell you anything about perhaps the ingredients or the way it was made? After the smell, yes, take a sip. You know, what's the weight of it? Is it heavy? Is it light? And in the wine world, people always ask me about body. We refer to things as being, you know, full-bodied or light-bodied. And I say it's very much like milk, in that milk you would consider to be full-bodied. 2% milk you would consider to be medium-bodied. Skim milk you would consider to be light-bodied. So you just little assists, if you will. And beyond that, every good beer judge is going to be looking for the same things as a good wine judge is. Now, it varies a little bit, yes, that a darker color in one doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as a darker color in the other. You know, a dark-colored beer does not equate to a dark-colored wine. And actually, if you'll let me run on here for a minute, James.
It makes my job easier if you do. So.
All right, great. People often ask the same group of people who kind of motivated me to write the book, what kind of wine can I give to my beer drinking friend that will be appropriate? And people make a very common mistake. And the first one is they equate color. So in other words, they think if a beer is dark, that they should consequently begin by giving this person a dark colored wine. Well, you know, as you know, a lot of dark beers are actually slightly sweet. You know, a lot of stouts and so forth and porters, they may have a sweetness to them as well as a little bitterness to them. But it really doesn't equate to a darker wine. You know, a darker wine is going to be darker because the grapes, the pulp, the mash grapes and the skins have sat together longer and the color has leached out of the skins. So actually, what I tell them is don't worry and don't try to equate colors. You know, people who drink light colored beer don't necessarily have a palate that's going to allow them to like light colored wine. So one good example, I think, is we've got the guy who loves an Imperial IPA. All right, well, when you pour that baby out in the glass, it's pretty light colored. Now, if you gave that person who's an IPA fan a glass of Pinot Grigio, which is a very light colored wine, it would be night and day. Because in the beer world, he or she is used to a rich, bold, you know, cutting, slap you in the face and get your attention, gustatory experience. Whereas Pinot Grigio is, you know, kind of one step up from water with a little wine flavoring in it. So the two don't equate at all. The color doesn't really tell you anything. And in wine, it's kind of the same thing. You can have very intensely flavored light wines and very intensely flavored dark wines.
Let's dip into the technical details just a minute. You talked about the differences between white wines and red wines. Back in the day, I thought that white wines came from green grapes and red wines came from purple grapes. But but that's not true. But talk about the differences in the production of those two, you know, sort of styles of wines and what each bring to the table.
Sure. First of all, 98% of all wine grapes have clear pulp and clear juice. So if you just squeeze them in your hand and drip them on the floor, that's going to be clear, whether it's a red grape or a white grape. Now, the difference is that red grapes contain a lot of anthocyanins, a lot of polyphenols in the skins. And so if you, as I alluded to earlier, if you mash these grapes up and you let them sit in the skins, the color and the flavor elements and the tannins and so forth all leach out of the skins into the juice, turning the juice red or purple, as the case may be, but also adding a whole lot of flavor. When you make white wine, the style that we make most white wine in is intended to be very clean and clear. So the white grapes are crushed, but then the juice is poured off the skins instantly, immediately. So it never comes in contact with the skins. So you've just got clear, what we call free run juice. And free run juice can be sweet and lovely, but it doesn't have the depth of flavor. It doesn't have the depth of aroma that you're often going to get with red wines because it has a substantially lower amount of anthocyanins and other polyphenols in it. Again, you can make white wine from red grapes. So one of the most famous examples would be a champagne called a Blanc de Noir, which means white from black. And this uses all black grapes, or two black grapes, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier. But these black grapes are squeezed and the juice is poured off immediately, and the resultant wine is a beautiful, clean, clear white wine. So you really just have to be aware of how it's being made. And again, when you've got the grapes that do have colored skins, red skins or purple skins or black skins, as the case may be. Those colors, which are present, also indicate, as I mentioned, aroma and tannin, which is what gives it structure, would be roughly equivalent perhaps to the bitterness in a beer, very roughly, but nonetheless, that's what gives it a structure. So there's also in modern winemaking an idea that the darker a wine is, the richer or better it is, which isn't necessarily true. But a lot of winemakers will leave the must, as it's called, or this mash grape and skins and so forth, will leave it on the skins for a very long time so that it absorbs a lot of color. So it's, you know, it's quite different from beer in that regard.
And you can take the wine once it's or the juice once it's extracted from the grapes, and you can either put it into a stainless steel fermenter, or you can put it into wood, you know, barrels, or so. It the differences continue after that. Are there some guidelines? Like, for example, can you age, or should you age a red wine more than a white wine, or is a white wine better fresh than a red, or are there some guidelines?
Well, there are some rules of thumb that have as many exceptions as you might imagine a rule of thumb to have. The wines that age best do have a good helping of anthocyanin in them. But they also have a good level of acidity. And acidity is something you don't talk about in beer making too much. But if you take a mouthful of wine, particularly a red wine, and you just let it sit in your mouth as you're sipping, you'll notice that the sides of your tongue begin to water, that your mouth actually begins to water. And that's because of the acid in the wine. And acid in wine is good for a couple of reasons. One is it allows the wine to age longer. Number two is that the acidity, through the very fact that it makes your mouth water, makes the wine very food friendly. So it's a great wine to have with food. And you will find, as an example, and this is, a big generalization, but you will find that Italian wines tend to be quite acidic. And Italian wines are actually designed and made to accompany food. Italians almost never drink red wine by itself. I mean, they just consider it another dish in the meal. So it makes it more juicy. What's actually happening, if you want to get a little geeky here, is that the acid is in the wine is telling your body, your tongue, that there's acid. And so your body, to defend against the lowering of the pH, starts to excrete saliva. And the purpose is for the saliva to nullify the lowered pH of the acid. So that's why your mouth waters. That's why your mouth waters at any time. It's really your body defending against an increase in acid. And your mouth will water with food, not because you're introducing acid into your mouth from a foreign substance like wine, but from your stomach, from your salivary glands. You're getting ready to digest this food that smells so good. And part of the response of your body, again, is to nullify the acid. And that's why we get this mouth-watering effect.
Now, we've got a lot of sour beer fans out there, so we
yes.
I have to call out to them. You know, we're familiar with the sour or the acidic aspects of the beverages too. Mm-hmm. You say that you talked about you know, whether to age a wine or not, and some wines actually benefit from aging and should be aged.
Some wines do. Let's be realistic, though. I would say, James, that probably 90% of wines are made to be drunk within 2 or 3 years of their vintage date, red or white. They're just not designed. I mean, they're consumer products. You know, they're not designed to go in someone's collection necessarily. They're designed to go on the store shelf and get turned over so that next vintage can come in and replace them. I mean, that's the commercial world we live in. There are wines that are designed to be aged because they have been for years, and they undergo a lot of transitions when they're aged. So, for instance, we talked about tannin, and for folks who aren't really familiar with tannin, think about drinking an incredibly strong tea, for instance, and it gives you that puckery effect in your mouth. That's the effect of tannins. So what happens when you age a wine that is young and bold and has a lot of those polyphenols we talked about is it tends to be very high in tannin, and it also tends to be very rich in color. When it ages, what happens is what's called polymerization, which means that the molecules of tannin link together with the molecules of the color, actual colorant in the wine, and they become too heavy and they drop out of suspension. So in an old bottle of wine, you'll often find sediment at the bottom. And this sediment is the result of this polymerization of the tannins and the coloring agents dropping out of suspension. What that does to the wine is by reducing the level of tannin, it smooths the wine out. So just as a tactile experience in your mouth, the wine is much smoother. And it also lightens the color. It's interesting, as red wine gets older, it goes through a series of stages where it will be, you know, maybe inky purple, and then it will be just kind of rich purple, and then maybe a ruby purple, and then maybe a ruby red, and then a little brickiness, a brick color around the edges, and then it will turn kind of orange bricky, and then it will get kind of brownish, and it will become brown eventually. Ironically, when white wine ages, it also becomes brown. So the older wines are, the more alike they actually look, whether they're red or white. And the white wine becomes brown because it's being oxidized. The red wine becomes brown because it's being oxidized, but it's also getting these color shifts. So it's quite interesting. You will also have what we refer to as tertiary flavors coming in. So in the wine world, they refer to primary flavors as the flavors of the grape itself. So, you know, take a handful of grapes and eat them up. And whatever flavors you're getting in there, the sweetness, the various fruit flavors, etc., those are the primary flavors. After the wine is fermented, or after the grapes are fermented, then we have what are called the secondary flavors. And these are things that are often the result of the fermentation process itself. And so they may add a little green pepper note to it. It may add, any number of sulfuric notes to it. Anyway, these are called the secondary flavors. And then the tertiary flavors are the flavors that come as a result of longer aging, being in wood. So when a wine is aged in wood, you'll begin to get flavors like possibly dill in American oak, possibly coconut, vanilla, tobacco, etc. So those are all what are called tertiary flavors, and you won't get those in a very young red wine. You only get those in a wine that's aged. So that's a big plus for aging.
And on the section of the book, when you talk about sensory evaluation, you said that by looking at your wine glass in a certain way, you can sort of tell if a wine has been aged or not. Talk about that.
When you're looking at a wine, when you're evaluating it visually, you should tilt it so that the surface instead of being a circle in a regular wine glass, now becomes an oval. So you've got the glass tilted over, and this is so you can more clearly discern the rim or the meniscus of the wine. And as a wine ages, those color shifts that I talked about, going from pure red or pure purple into an orange or an amber or a brown. And if you look at a wine and you tilt it to the side and it's perfectly clear at the edge, or the edge color is exactly the same as the color in the middle, that's a giveaway that it's a very young wine. On the other hand, if you look at it and maybe in the middle of the surface of the wine, it's a rich ruby red, but then around the edges, it kind of looks kind of bricky, a little brick coloring, a little orange coloring starting. That's telling you that this is a wine that's beginning to age. It has a few more years on it. And the extremes just continue as the wine gets older.
So that's a little tip that the beer lover can take into a wine tasting and potentially impress, you know, some fellow wine geeks.
Absolutely. You know, just hold that glass up and tilt it over and take a look. And if you see some brown around the edge, then just say, oh, this is a few years old, isn't it? You know, or something witty like that. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, and there are reasons for other things. You know, people often ask about the swirling. You know, what's with the swirling of the wine glass all the time? And actually, the purpose of swirling is to coat the inside of the glass with a very thin layer of wine. And by thin, I'm talking a molecule or two thick. And the reason is because if it's very thin like that, it evaporates quickly. It's a volatile substance. And so if you swirl your glass and then stick your nose down in it, that wine will evaporate very quickly into your nasal passages, and it will give you the clues that you want, the aromas and the smells. Whereas if you never swirl and just sits there, you're not going to smell as much because those volatile substances aren't being released into the atmosphere.
You'll see beer geeks swirling our glasses in a similar fashion. But whereas, you know, we get foam sticking on the inside of the glass, or hopefully, you know, when we swirl around, when you're looking at a glass of wine, you get some visual clues about what's sticking to the side of the glass as well.
Well, you do. And you're looking for the depth of the actual color, the depth of the color, and how clear and clean the liquid is. And these things can tell you, as in the beer world, they can tell you any number of things. Once you're really practiced, and practice sounds like a big word, but it just means drink a lot, you know.
It's research.
Absolutely. Same whether you're studying beer or wine or bourbon or whatever it is. Practice means you drink a lot. But it also means you pay attention when you're drinking. That's the difference, I guess. But there are certain shades. So, for instance, some wines will never be dark red. If you look, for instance, at a Pinot Noir, you'll never find a really dark, deep Pinot Noir, because the skins of Pinot Noir just do not contain that level of anthocyanins that will give you that dark, rich color. So if I look at a glass of wine and no one's told me what it is, and I look in there and it's kind of inky black, I mean, it's really deep and rich, the first thing I can do is cross Pinot Noir off the list. I know it's not going to be a Pinot Noir. It just, Pinots never get that dark. So, you know, there's a lot of this trial and error stuff and just learning.
It's helpful in this way to have a reference, because this isn't just stuff that you can just know. This is stuff that you've got to learn by experience and by tasting and by taking notes and keeping a record of your own preferences. But you do a good job in the book of talking about different styles of or varieties of grapes, and then talking about the different regions of the world where grapes are grown and wine is made. And that's important because, say, you know, in Northwest Arkansas, a brewery can order the proper ingredients and do the proper water chemistry and come up with a world-class Pilsner that is, you know, typical of the region where Pilsner was first brewed.
Sure.
But you can't do that if you're a winery.
Right. Well, you shouldn't do that. Let's put it that way. You shouldn't do that. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, Northwest Arkansas and Czechoslovakia are not the same place. And it's one of the, I think, the major differences is that beer is brewed from a commodity, that being barley primarily, which can be grown and stored indefinitely and shipped to anywhere. So, yes, I can grow barley or hops here, there, or anywhere, harvest it, store it, ship it, and you can make beer with it, and the beer is going to be great. It's going to show all the characteristics of the particular variety and so forth, and it's going to work well. With wine, you have much less room, if you will, to improvise. You know, you get a harvest once a year, and that's it. And every wine variety, grape variety, reflects the place that it was grown to a much greater degree than grains do. So if I grow Merlot in part of France called Bordeaux, it's going to be a very different animal than if I grow that same Merlot in Southern California. It's going to taste different. It's going to have different levels of tannins, different aromas, etc. Now, it's still going to be, to someone who really knows wine, it's still going to be identifiable as a Merlot, but it's going to be a very different animal. So when I said, yes, but you shouldn't, what I was referring to is that a lot of factory wine, and believe me, folks, all of you wonderful craft brewers who got into the business or into the passion of craft brewing because you wanted to get away from what was being sold on the shelves, the lovely American lager, the light American lager, whatever the term is that's being used these days, you know what I'm talking about. There is a wine or a vinous equivalent to that. And you will see places that don't identify on the bottle where they are from. So instead of, let's say, a bottle from California, instead of saying it's from Napa Valley or it's from Sonoma or it's from, even more specifically, Russian River Valley or Paso Robles or whatever, it will simply say California. That's all the geographic indication will give you. Well, what that means is that these grapes were grown anywhere in the state. They were shipped in, they were trucked in, they were put together, and you're getting essentially a factory wine. So it's the same thing as in the beer world. We also are fighting something else that is happening in the beer world, and that's consolidation. There are two or three major corporations in the wine world that have for years been sucking up wineries. Mm. And unfortunately, in most cases, the wineries they bought were fairly interesting, distinctive, but small. And yet you knew that this particular winery put out a really good Cabernet Franc, or they put out a really good Meritage blend, or whatever it is. And yet one of the big behemoths buys them, and two or three years later, they've been used to to plug in a price point in this corporate wine producer's portfolio. They no longer have any personality. The grapes aren't made from grapes grown on that particular estate anymore. They're now just shipped in from whatever. They're made by formula. The winemakers have become recipe followers. It's very common. And we were talking a little earlier. I lived in Chicago for many years, and I was there when Goose Island, as an example, was bought out. What do you do with Goose Island if you're a craft lover at this point? Yes, they have maintained some integrity. They still make some pretty good beers, but they've also lost a lot. And some of the beers that used to be great are just mediocre at best now. And as in the beer world, in the wine world, these corporations are buying up a lot too many wineries, as far as I'm concerned. Mm. And yet there's always someone, a young couple or someone who is a new winemaker who wants to go out on his own or their own and do their own thing. So you've got to keep looking for those people.
So it sounds like, all in all, Jim, beer drinkers and wine drinkers have a lot in common, and there's nothing saying that we can't all get along, if not all kind of mingle together in our tastes, in our drinking preferences.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. We have a lot more in common than we think. I mean, it's like the humans and the chimps, you know, 99.9% of our DNA is the same. That may be a bad analogy, but
and some of us, our knuckles drag the ground. But other than that,
well, one thing that I tell people, and I think this will tell you a little bit about where my attitude lies in all this. People ask me, what's the best wine to bring to a party? I mean, I get that all the time. In the summer, it's a barbecue. You know, in the winter, it's Christmas party or the Super Bowl party or whatever the case may be. So my answer always is about variety. Mm. I said, it doesn't matter what your guest list is, bring three or four wines that you think are interesting and worth trying that you would like to share. And also on that same table where you're laying out the booze, make sure you bring three or four great craft brews, because some of your people you may think you're a wine person and all your friends and associates are winos, but you put some good beer out there and I guarantee it's going to be gone by the end of the night. So take care of everybody that you invite to your home. You know, take care of everybody and show them all the hospitality. Get some great beer for your beer-loving friends and get some great wine for your wine-loving friends and sit down with each other and try each other's favorite drink and just have a great time. Because in the end, whether it's beer or whether it's wine, the whole idea is to give us pleasure and to enhance our sociability.
There you go. Amen, brother. We've just scratched the surface on the books, a beer drinker's guide to knowing and enjoying fine wine, and 50 ways to love. Once you start loving wine, you go to 50 ways to love wine more: adventures in wine appreciation. Both of them are fun reads, and you've opened my eyes and taught me some things, and I appreciate your coming on.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a delight. I always love talking about fermented beverage of any stripe, and I wish you and your audience good drinking.
Same to you. Thanks, Jim. Well, thanks again to Jim. As I said in the interview, we just scratched the surface. Jim gives a lot of technical info in the book and gives a great overview, you know, kind of geographically of where the better wine varieties come from. So it's a fun resource. If you're just getting into, if you're just like me, if you're a wine newbie. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.